Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website at www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Thanks. We love to hear from you. Now, this week we're going to discuss creating teams. We're going to discuss team building. Now, last week we discussed motivating participants to actively participate, motivating people to really do it and not just come and sit there and be completely passive. And I got a lot of emails, thank you very much for your participation and your interest, that told me what I had really talked about was team building. And you know what? You're probably right. But you know how I feel about rather overused words like networking and team building, because they get a life of their own. They get a connotation that doesn't really have anything to do with us. And so you have to be careful about that and not go, well, I know what team building means. Well, in this context, we're going to think about it. By the way, thank you very much for the listeners who are returning. And for people who are new and for people who have forgotten, if you would like to hear last week's show or the last five shows that we've done together, they are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. The prior shows, the other ones that are older than the last five, are archived on the radio station, which is blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks. I hope you enjoy them. And I always learn something from these shows, and I hope you do too. So, we were talking about motivating participation last week, and this week we're going to delve a little bit more into team building, because that is indeed, you are right, that is what we talked about last week, really. We just didn't call it team building. And so, now let's think about this, and one of the main questions that I had was how to get a team and how many should be on a team and what a team should look like. What does that mean so that you can get participation in rather like subgroups? Now, those of you who have been to one of my seminars, one of my workshops, and seen it done know that I think, and yes, I'm going to say the famous word. People are already typing this in. You must all think I say this constantly. And I do. I'm going to say the words, it depends, aren't I? But it seems to me that there are many ways to make a team, many ways to get participation, like we talked about last week. But you first need to decide if you're actually going to create small groups or you're going to make the entire group in the room, all of the participants, become members of a single team. And I think, although it depends on the situation, that you need to give that very careful thought. It is my first inclination. And I see, thank you for your participation. I see that people are already sending in and they're voting, so to speak. And I see a lot of people think you should make different teams amongst the group. It is my first inclination because of a great deal of experience and because, of course, we all deal with the same kind of types of community, types of issues regularly. The participants change, but oftentimes the type of issues don't. It is my inclination to have everyone be on the same team. And yes, people are saying that that is unwieldy. And I suppose that is, but you have to think about whether or not you're going to create a competitive animosity between your members of your community, your members of your group, the members of your meeting, that will be less advantageous than having us all pull together as the same team. You see, and yes, I see that quite a few of you are saying that you get too many people on a team, it falls apart. This is true. I do indeed think that a meeting, a gathering, a mediation group is preferable, not to be more than, let's think about this for a moment, because I hate to give numbers. If you get more than a dozen people all needing to voice their view, all leaders in some way, all people with a very strong opinion, you're going to have quite a few people who all need to have the floor, so to speak, who all need to speak. So my ideal is to have a team that is not that many people, right? That's about a dozen. And more than that, you have to think about it. Now, I see that Jean is telling me that it depends if the sides are close to each other or if there's true dissension amongst them. And if the sides are close to each other, Jean says that it is easy to make several teams because they all do work together and they do research and think alike and come and report. And yes, I saw a lot of you during the week did indeed mention that the way to motivate participation, active participation, is to give assignments for smaller groups like subgroups, subteams. I hate to use the word subcommittee because we all know that when things get into committee, they get bogged down. So we're going to call them different teams that are all working together, right? Right. But you can call them whatever you want, but they're smaller groups that have been given an assigned task. This is indeed good motivation to participate. And yes, if the parties are actually fairly close, they have a common goal in mind, they have really agreed upon the common goal, and what is being discussed is the manner in which to reach that goal, then yes, you can have people bringing viewpoints of what to do. The question is always, and the thing that needs the most thought, and see, yeah, people are asking if each side is a subteam of the whole. Yes, well, yeah, I know. I'm going to say it again, aren't I? I'm going to say it depends, because you have to give this careful thought. I prefer to have everyone be on the same team and not delineate different people to different sides, even if they're fairly close, because it has been my experience, and I see that some of you are agreeing with me and having the same experience, it makes polarization. It has been my experience that even if they're close together, you've got the danger of having people take a side away from other team members, you see? And then they kind of feed off each other's biases. And I see that people are saying that it reinforces preconceived notions, which is, of course, something we've talked about. It reinforces preconceived notions and prejudices to make teams and to have them splinter off. I see the word splinter here, and I don't know that they're splinter groups exactly because you've made them. They're not something that happened on their own or happened because someone forced the issue rather without consulting the group. We're talking about teams that are formed really up front. But you can get polarization. You can get people feel that they belong with these four people and their position is right, and the other two groups of four people, their position is wrong. And that doesn't get you very far, does it? Because your idea is to start marching down the same path. That's what I really do. I see that there's a lot of discussion about it. Thank you very much for participating. And I see that there's a very valid point that if you've got an issue that needs some further research or some expertise. Yes, Jennifer says that the main reason for making a group that is smaller, like a subgroup within the team, is if some team members have special expertise. You know, that's a good point. Sometimes you do have an issue that needs some special expertise, and there are people in your group who are particularly proficient. They particularly know something. They're in the profession of whatever it is that you need, or they have access to help. They have access to some sort of information that the other team members, the other group members, really could use and really could use their expertise. You see? And I'm having a lot of questions about whether or not if you have, well this is what Robert says, and it's kind of the theme that is occurring. If you have different sides, different viewpoints, do you make teams of people from each viewpoint, sub-teams, you see? For example, there are four viewpoints, four issues. Do you take one person from each of those sides and make Team A, and one person from each of those sides and make Team B? Do I understand everybody's thinking that way? Yes. This is the part where I say it depends again, don't I? Yes. It's a judgment call. And as you become more experienced, you'll be able to perhaps form a judgment more quickly. But the main thing to do is to sit down and give it some thought. Because it has been my experience that a lot of times you have the law of unintended consequences. You see, you think, well, that will make people really bond if we get people from each side together in smaller groups and they have to do something together. It's possible. It is possible that that will happen. You have to think about the people, not the group as a whole, not the opinions as a whole, but the actual people, because this is a people call. Sometimes it's a group, a peer pressure call, but this is a people one. You have to think about the people very carefully, because it is possible that that will be a wonderful, advantageous thing to do, and that you will get further if people have to work with each other and cooperate with each other. That is a good possibility. On the flip side, and I see that there has been some experience with this, I see several people are saying, Jennifer and Salma and Martin and other people, thank you for your participation. On the flip side, it is very possible, too, and that's why you have to think about it beforehand, that what will happen is that preconceived notions and biases will be reinforced. That's bad, right? Right. Because it means that people will not want to work with each other on a real personal basis. Got to think about the personalities involved. And, oh, Jennifer says, what happens if you make a mistake and you realize it after it's done, after you've kind of assigned the people? This, my friends, is why if you're going to attempt such a thing and you're going to give, for example, a research assignment, or we'll call it a homework assignment, an assignment that needs some cooperation between the smaller teams, some cooperation between the team members. We're going to call them sub-teams, the members of each sub-team, because I think everybody in the room is a team, right? We're all working towards a goal. We're all motivated, we're all participating, and we're all working towards a common goal. So we're going to call them sub-teams. If you make a mistake, or the sub-teams form kind of organically, as in you did not act as the host like a physical education teacher and form teams. You didn't pick people. They kind of picked each other. Do you understand? Well, yes, I see that there's a great deal of understanding of what I'm saying, that people are telling me that they don't form the team. This is not where you pin up on a bulletin board and say you're going to form team A and team B, that these things happened by nodding and agreement and by kind of in the negotiation, in the natural progression of things. Teams start to form and people get together and do research and they volunteer to do something and then someone else volunteers to do something else. And then people say, I will help you. And you know what I mean? It becomes kind of an organic thing and not really an assignment. Pardon me. Pardon me. I guess this really is a live show. Hello. I'm sorry about that. But if you see that a mistake has been made, and the question is being asked, people agreeing with Jennifer, what happens if it's really not working? And we've got either dissension or we've got a team that has gotten together and decided to not cooperate with the others. Ooh, that's always interesting. We've got a little bit of peer mentality here, right? Right. If you've got such a thing, that's why we try not to have assignments, try not to have needs that are too ongoing. You see, the trick is to be specific to the next meeting and not to forever and a day. You see, the trick is to be specific. We will get together, you and you will get together and work on the research and work on the argument pro or the argument con and present it at the next meeting, you see? And then after the meeting is up and you go, oh, that wasn't such a good idea, you don't make that team again. You kind of switch around partners. Or you don't have sub-teams, at least for a while, and you make the whole group the team. You see, it's a matter of shifting the people. And that's kind of why I prefer that we deem all of us a team and we just have special projects that some people are more capable of doing, you see. I'm not fond of competition. I think there's enough. If we're all getting together because we're having a problem reaching a common goal or a common good, then there's probably enough dissension amongst the parties, you see. And competition doesn't necessarily help that. I see that there's some disagreement with my opinion. And thank you very much for your participation. People are telling me that competition will drive people to find solutions because they want to be the team that finds the solution. Well, you know, if if that, my advice is always go with what works. If it works, it works. It depends on your group. It depends on the issue. It depends on the type of people that you're dealing with. It depends on how many sides there are, you see, and how far enough they are. And oftentimes, I'm getting some questions about how big should a sub-team be. For example, we have an assignment, and we're going to do some homework, and it could use more than one person on it, or more than one person is doing the same assignment, which makes them into kind of a team, little sub-team. I'm going to, you know, it's hard to give a number. I think small for a sub-team. It's hard enough to keep track of them and to see how the flow is going if they're small. It, of course, depends how many people are in your group, how many people are at this community gathering, this meeting, this workshop, this seminar, whatever it is you're doing. It depends how many you start with. I think a small group should not be more than 4. I don't like to give a number, and I've already got dissension. Oh, that's a good point. I have quite a few people that are telling me that a small group should be an odd number in case they need to vote, and then you won't have a tie. You won't have a deadlock. It's a good point. Very, very good point. I didn't think about them voting within themselves. But, of course, there's discussion amongst the small group members so that they can present a unified opinion, a unified research, a unified whole to the entire group the next time. So in that case, I'm going to – that's a very good point that you need a tiebreaker, so to speak, if you do need such a thing. So I'm going to revise my opinion and say 3, because there would be a tiebreaker in that. You get too big, and I see that people are agreeing with that. You get too big, it's hard to coordinate amongst the small group members. You've had that, where you can't reach somebody or the timing's off and they don't answer their emails so fast and it's hard to find them by phone. And good heavens, I hope we don't have to all find a date when we can actually meet together, because that's really evil. And, you know, it's all the logistics of it will get very complex. I know there's Skype and things, but it still gets complex. And we're getting into accord, having a mediation, reaching agreement and compromise. Oh, we all know it's sufficiently complex without making it harder, without having to keep track, without really making life difficult. Make it as easy as it can be, and you'll get further faster. You'll get repeaters, and you'll get somewhere. You'll get done. This is not—it's not supposed to be a lifelong project on the same thing. We want to get it done, get it over with, get it going. Which is why we need the active participation, and yes, we do need the team playing, don't we? And a lot of people are telling me that Martin and Jennifer and Terrence and like that, they're telling me that the best kind of a team is an actual assignment where you need to do some sort of research and bring it back to the whole group. Yes, and you know, a very good point is being made by Ray and Celeste, and I think this is absolutely true, and I do it a lot. If you're going to have an assignment that needs some research, that needs some pro and con presentation, for example, and should not be just one viewpoint, a third party impartial is rather invaluable in those situations. And It is possible, of course, and I have done this, depending on budget and depending on who you've got, it is possible to actually hire a third-party impartial, right? To hire a professional mediator. That's what I do in real life. But it is possible to hire someone if you've got the budget for it. But a lot of community groups do not have such a thing. A lot of nonprofits do not have such a thing. A lot of, you know, just people do not have the luxury of that. And yes, Salma and Jennifer and Martin and Lyle, a lot of people are telling me that what they do is they use volunteers. And this is very good. People in the community who are interested, you can take a survey, you can do research, you can do the internet, you can have a presentation. You do not want too many because that's too many presentations. And you don't want them to overlap, and you don't want them to have dissension. Yes, of course not. Yes, and people are saying that volunteers are hard to deal with. Well, volunteers, you got to kind of pick them just like everything else. And they need to be given some instruction, some direction. You can't just say to a volunteer, go out and do good. Go out and find something. Most volunteers need to have a little more instruction than that. And, I'm getting some crazy volunteer stories. Yeah, there's the occasional interesting case. Yes, that's always interesting, yeah. So, that happens, and, well, these things happen, yes. And so volunteers from the community, the perhaps best kind of volunteer is an intern from a school, right? If you can hook up with a neighboring, with a area college, for example, even high schoolers, depending on the issue, might be very interested in working on a project. Yes. And it's wonderful because they don't cost you anything, right? That's what an intern is. And they get credit. Now, you will indeed have to be specific, and you do indeed have to, well, I suppose grade is kind of the right statement about this. You do have to grade your interns because they get a pass-fail or something so that they can get the school credit. But interns are a wonderful thing, and they are interested. And I see that Alma says that she has interns that oftentimes are doing a dissertation paper on the area that her community group is in. She does medical issues and consumer issues and like that. People do dissertations on this and how to do it. And they, of course, are very experienced. And that's a wonderful thing. They are interested in it. And they are experienced. But interns, you know, interns are wonderful. And when I say an intern, that does not necessarily imply a child. It does not imply a young person. It could be a person that is a returner to school, for example. Somebody who's doing an MBA. Somebody who's getting community work credit for work. But they are more interested, and they are, to a great extent, dependable. So that's wonderful. Interns are a great thing. We have lots of interns. It's wonderful. And I'm getting some questions about young interns. Well, you know I'm going to say it depends again. But I really, really, really think that you should not use underage people. I know I'm going to get some people that say that their high schoolers are just magnificent and they go on projects, and there's all kinds of wonderful organizations that have teenagers who go on projects and learn all about the world. And yes, and I appreciate all of them, and I think it's an excellent idea. I've never really used people who are less than college because we as an organization do not have the manpower or the time for that much oversight. People who are very young need to have more oversight, and of course you need to protect them more. That's very important. So I'm very protective of that, and I do not, if you've got the oversight and if you've got, especially if they come through an organization that has an organizational structure, yes, high schoolers are very enthusiastic and very wonderful people. I'm not experienced in that, and so you would have to, in my opinion, I would go through an organization, and I would try to not just not just get them out of law school, out of high school. I was thinking the law school is a good place too, and oftentimes students and other people who are interested in the community will work for a small stipend too, if you've got the wherewithal to do it. So yes, that's wonderful, and they do wonderful reasoned research, and you do have to have meetings and have direction. This is not just to go out into the world and find something out type thing. You have to be able to put some time into it and to give some direction with volunteers and with interns and with everyone else. And really also with your team members, with your community members, you need to be able to keep track, right? Yes. They're not just to go out into the world and have no direction. You see, that's the key to make this. And Brianna and Ray and Jeremy and like that I'm getting words like Pandora's box. Everyone knows what Pandora's box is, yes. Pandora opened a box, and it's an old legend. You can Google it, and all kinds of strange things came out. And that's why we have a little bit of oversight of our team members. And that's why they make a report regularly so that we can think about it, we can discuss it, and we can go forward. We can ask them questions, you see, and you don't just kind of let them keep going and get all wound up and enthusiastic on something that's a side issue but does not keep us going in the proper direction. Mm-hmm. And, I have quite a few people, and then, yes, I am going to get to the recipe part of our show, but I have quite a few people over the weekend, also for now, who are saying that they use a reward system, for lack of a better term, when they're forming teams and getting active participation. And the reward system is a concept, well, it depends on the nature of your group. I know I've said it depends again. And the reason I've said it depends is because you have to have a group that's competitive in a good-natured manner. Does that make any sense? They need to be, yes, people say, no, that makes no sense at all. How can you be competitive in a good-natured manner? Well, if you're going to have a reward and team members are going to compete for something. For example, I see a lot of people give a prize for best presentation. I assume the prize is small, right? It's not something big. But if you're going to go that route, you don't want to have animosity occur because people become rather competitive. And then they feel ripped off, you see? And nobody likes to lose. And everybody, even if the prize is small, it's not the point of the thing. You know, it's the idea of getting it. Does that We all know that. Sometimes the prize is really intrinsically worthless, but we want to have it to show that we won it, you see, and to wear it around our neck or something. But if you're going to have a first of all, you're going to have to decide who's going to judge it. I don't know. You see, people are saying the host judges that because you're in charge. Oh, I don't want to do that as the host, if I can possibly help it. It's like judging a beauty contest. Well, you're all beautiful to me, right? You all tried really hard, and you all did a good job. It's not that someone didn't do a good job. Who judges better? Who judges more beautiful, and on what criteria? Ooh, I don't know about hosts judging. People are telling me it works out okay, but that it depends, as they say. So you need to be able to do it without creating hard feelings. And Ray says you can have it where everyone gets a prize. Yes, you can, but that's not much of a competition. I mean, I'm all in favor of prizes, just like I'm all in favor of snacks and food breaks and all kinds of convivial atmosphere. But it's going to be hard to judge a clear cut unless you've got a group that really has... Wow, I don't know about the host judging. I suppose it's my preference. That is my personal personality. That's true. People are saying that's because I don't want to. And that is absolutely true. It's just something that I would not like to do. And therefore, I cringed and went, I don't know about that. Because, wow, to be the judger of best is a concept. We've got people that are telling me they have other prizes. We've got you get to talk first. Well, that's a prize I would like, I suppose. Let's see, you won the presentation prize the last time, so you get to talk first this time. Well, okay. That's a prize. That's still a judgment, though. An extra floor time, that's extra talking time, as they say. And, oh, here's an evil one. Karen says, it depends. I'm sorry. If it works, it works. You know that I think that and that I always say, if it actually works, go with it. And Karen says that the prize for the best presentation and the most research and the most reasoned opinion is that you get to choose the next meeting place. That would be a pretty big prize. Do you get to choose someone else's home? Oh, no, just kidding. Choose the next meeting place. And Chris and several other people, actually, tell me that they, instead of judging a presentation or a research or an assignment or something, they have a food competition because, you know, we're making a convivial atmosphere and we are having, basically speaking, a potluck. And that they have like a gold medal for the people vote which dish they like the best of. They throw in a little vote in a hat and somebody counts. And Chris says that they are creating a recipe book like that. They take the ones that get the medal, and they're going to create a recipe book, which is actually kind of cool. Okay. I guess I think, let's see, food judging. I think food judging, that still means somebody doesn't win. And you know my theory that when you do one of these, when you do a mediation, when you do a meeting, when you do a get-together, you know my theory is that everybody should feel that they won and no one's a loser. If it works for your group, it works for your group. And I think food judging is safer than opinion and research judging. and people are disagreeing with me. I think I'm losing. because people are sensitive about their food, and this is true. And I'm sensitive about my food, and I like people to like it. And therefore, I would want the gold medal. This is all true. And Steve has my personal favorite, which is going to be a great segue into our recipe portion, our potluck recipe portion. Steve says that the reward for doing the best job and getting the most doing the most work is that you get to eat first. Yay! What a concept. You did the best. You get to have the biggest piece of cheddar onion tapai, which we're about to talk about. And yes, people are already writing this in, and thank you very much for your participation. And thank you also for the people that have called in. Please do email and send it in. We don't really do live callers on this show, the reason being that it is timed. And I don't. And if we take live callers, it takes so much time that it's hard to do because we get so many people calling in. So thank you very much for doing that, and thank you for all of your participation. But we don't really do the live caller thing, the live actual verbal caller. Oops, I just threw something over. Oh, this really is a live show. And because it is the time factor on it. And you know, it makes for a kind of a neater show. We've tried it both ways, and you actually heard it both ways for a while there. And we went, well, maybe we should go for the write-ins and talk about it and like that. Because then we have everybody, a lot of people have the same basic question. And if we do the live callers, then we answer the same basic question, and we only get to one question for the whole time. We get to one question, and it's because people ask the same question. So thank you very much. And those of you who are new and are trying to live call, please do send it in. We will, and it will get answered kind of in a group, so to speak. I know that's a little bit clumsier, but it kind of works on a time basis. So thank you very much for all of your participation. Okie dokie. Now, yes, we are getting to the recipe portion. Thank you for asking. Like, when are we getting there? Yes, we're getting there now. And, of course, for the people who are new and for the people who have been with us before, been here before, I always say the same thing, don't I? Yes, I do. I can't help it. When you're going to do a potluck, when you're going to do even a catered or anything like that, you will, first of all, contact your participants and ask if they have any food prohibitions, and you will respect them, and you will send it around if it's really an allergy or religious or a different kind of prohibition, and you will have everyone please, yes, you're all writing it in, you will have everyone please label the food very carefully that they bring. Because people have allergies, people have religious prohibitions, and people have dietary restrictions. We want to create a convivial atmosphere. We don't want anybody getting sick or panicky or offended. We want everyone to have a good experience. So we're going to label everything very clearly. Now we're going to have two recipes, and you know that I call the first one the safe recipe because I think the host should have extra food. And we are the host, usually speaking. And one of the things that I really think we should have is that we should have a recipe that most people can eat. And that is fairly obvious by looking at it and by reading a fairly short list of ingredients, what is in it. We're going to label it carefully, and we're going to pick something that doesn't have ingredients that are highly unusual, a great many of them, so that it's hard to read how many are in there when you label it, and mostly that you can see. That you pretty much are obvious in the item. So our safe recipe is going to be a cheddar onion pie. Now, I confess that I'm going to tell you that I'm going to use a frozen pie crust that you get in the grocery store, in the freezer department. If you want to do so, I'm sure yours will come out much more deliciously than mine. If you use a homemade pie crust, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that in the interests of time and expediency, I usually use one of the frozen ones, and it comes out just fine. The more homemade, of course, the better, but you must, of course, label whatever it is you are using, and do be cautious about using lard. And look at the ingredients, because there are a lot of religious prohibitions about pork. Okay, cheddar onion pie, delicious. We're going to use 2 tablespoons of butter, 4 cups of sliced onions. I like these sweet onions, like Vidalia? Is that what they're called? Yes. The sweet onions, and we're going to slice them real thin using either a food processor or a mandolin or something. 4 cups. About 1/2 teaspoon of salt. I like a little bit of dried thyme in there, like 1/2 teaspoon. And we're going to have 1 cup of salsa. All right, 3/4 cup of salsa. We don't need a whole cup. 3/4 cup of salsa that we're going to drain. We're going to take off the watery part. Yes, if you make it yourself, I'm certain that that's absolutely wonderful. I'm afraid that I actually use just a jar of salsa and drain it real carefully with a paper towel. And kind of drain it through and so that it's still moist, but it's not wet. And then we're going to use the 9-inch pie crust, an unbaked refrigerated one. It's what I usually use. You can use what you please. And about a little better than 1/2 cup of shredded cheddar cheese. So we're going to preheat our oven to 350. And then we're going to take our butter and then we're going to melt it in a large saucepan. And we're going to add the onions, the salt, and the thyme. And we're going to stir it all over, and we're going to cook it And we're going to cook it about 5 minutes, stirring it periodically so it doesn't get burned, so that it all gets incorporated. Then we're going to make it kind of a low heat, and we're going to continue and cook it and stir it about 15 minutes until the onions are all nicely caramelized. And that you have to watch. You have to stir that regularly, or you're going to get them stuck to the bottom. So you're going to have the caramelized onions and the salt and the thyme and like that and the butter, all nice and caramelized. And then we're going to stir in our salsa after we've got the onions caramelized. This is a really easy recipe. It's just delicious. Then we're going to take our pie crust, our 9-inch pie crust, and we're going to stick it in a 9-inch pan, of course, right? Right. I personally like to use a tart pan because it is even all around on the sides and less deep. You can use what you please, but this will come out better looking and more full looking if you use one of those 9-inch tart pans and not really a pie crust tin. Yes, because they are flatter. It will fill a little bit better and more evenly. Okay, so we're going to put in a tart pan. And I know that some of you say you don't need to. I usually say one of those little tart pans with a removable bottom, the springform pans, because it just makes it easier, and I don't have to try prying this out. So we're going to have a pie crust in a 9-inch tart pan with a removable bottom. And we're going to, of course, to poke the crust, right? Yes, they probably tell you that on the package. Poke the crust with a fork. And we're going to spread the onion and salsa mixture evenly over the bottom of it. Just spread it all around the caramelized onion and the salsa. Then we're going to bake it for, about 20 minutes until the pie crust browns on all the sides. Then we're going to take the cheddar cheese and we're going to put it all over the top. We're going to bake it another 5 minutes until the cheese gets melty is the trick to this. Then we're going to remove it and let it stand. I think everything should stand for a little while before you cut it, because I guess I'm clumsy. No, because I think it makes everything firm up a smidge. I think it should sit on the counter for about, it's hot anyway, for about 10 minutes before you try to serve it and cut it, because it firms it up. So we're going to really bake the pie crust with the onion and salsa mixture and then put the cheddar cheese on top and bake that until it gets nice and soft. If you're going to bring this someplace, I usually bake the caramelized onions and everything. I do the bottom. I take the cheese with me. And if I've got an oven there, I finish it off there with the cheddar cheese. And then I let it sit for the 10 minutes or so. It smells delicious in the room anyway, and everybody goes, ooh, what's that? And if you let it sit, if you do the cheese at the last minute, it will be delicious and very bubbly. If you don't have the ability to use an oven where you're going, make it ahead of time. It's fine. Okay, so that is our safe recipe. It has not too many ingredients. It's basically vegetarian. And it's not vegan, of course, but it's just got the cheese. But it is delicious. Most people like it. And it makes a lovely presentation. And that was for one pie's worth, but of course you can make extra if you have a lot of people. So now let's go to our adventure recipe. This has a little bit more unusual ingredients, and there's a whole longer list of them. So it's possible that someone might be allergic to something or be rather unfamiliar. You see, so that's why we're going to label it. But it's a delicious adventure recipe, and this one is good if you have a community kitchen. You have the ability to make something with everyone as you're standing there. Or you can make it while people are around, because it's fast to make, it smells delicious, and everyone can participate, and it's very interesting to look at. So this one's kind of cool if you can have we'll call them an audience, if you can have participation. So it's coconut fried rice with chicken, I'm going to call it. So we've got 2 cups of water, and about 1.5 cups of coconut milk powder. You can use coconut milk also, but of course then you don't use the water, right? Right, yes. I usually use the powder just because I have it, and it's easier to come by while I am. And we have about 2 cups of rice. Technically speaking, you would use 2 tablespoons of peanut oil. I shy away from peanut oil because so many people are allergic to peanuts. And you sure don't want them to get sick in some way. So I'm going to say 2 tablespoons of oil. Peanut will give it a little better taste, but not so much better that I think you should take the chance. We're going to have 2 chopped garlic cloves. We're going to have an onion that we're going to chop up. A nice chunk of fresh ginger root grated, like 1-inch piece or so, and grated up nice and fine. And then we're going to have about 3/4 pound of skinless, boneless chicken breast fillets that we're actually going to cut into chunks. A red bell pepper that we're going to seed, of course, and then slice real thin, or you can make it in a dice if you like the look of it better with the chicken. You've got chunks of chicken. I kind of think it looks a little nicer with chunks of red pepper, too. I actually add in corn just because I think that the corn is sweet and it's delicious. I'm afraid that I actually used canned corn. I used 1 cup of drained corn kernels, the kind that are packed in water, I guess is what they're packed in. But the kind that don't have the extra sugar, is that what they put in? People say yes, the heavy sauce. I like the kind that are vacuum packed and kind of plump. But you need to drain them really well. So 1 cup of that, 1 cup of drained canned corn kernels. Yes, you can use fresh if you'd like. people go, can I use Fresh? Yes, of course you can use Fresh. It's just that it's kind of easier if you use the ones that come out of the, oh, well, never mind, you know. Two eggs, two beaten eggs, a pinch of salt, and a little bit of curry powder will give it a more of an Asian taste, which is kind of cool. I usually use about a teaspoon of curry powder. Okay. Now, we're going to pour the water into a pan and whisk in the coconut milk powder. Of course, if you're going to use coconut milk, you don't do that. We're going to add the rice and bring it to a boil. See, we're boiling the rice in the coconut milk, which is why I think the water and the powder works a little bit better, so it gets infused with the flavor. We're going to put it on low heat and cook it for, what, about 15 minutes until the rice is soft and all the liquid's been absorbed. And then we're going to do something odd. And this is my tip for all stir fries. And sometimes I forget to say it, and then people make the recipe and they go, it came out really greasy. And when you do a stir fry, a rice stir fry like this is, when after you make the delicious yummy rice in the coconut milk water that's been absorbed, you kind of spread it out, you make it early, and you let it get cold. Because if you fry hot rice, it will absorb too much of the oil and you will get a greasy product. Now, that's not fatal and nobody's going to die from it, but it's not going to be quite as yummy, right? And that's just one of those little stir-fry tricks that you kind of learn. It doesn't need to be refrigerated. People ask me if you refrigerate it. No, you don't need to refrigerate it, but let it cool. Don't make the rice right with everything and mix it together. Make it a little ahead of time and let it cool down. Okay, so we're going to heat the oil in a big pan. Yes, people are saying a wok. Yes, if you've got a wok, I don't actually own one. It's kind of it's the same as a pan, really, and with big size. And we're going to add the garlic, the onion, the ginger, and we're going to stir fry it for about 2 minutes. See, this is why this is good for a community kitchen, for a group, because it's fast and it smells fantastic. You can make the rice ahead of time and then do the get all the things together, the dicing, the whole bit, and the ingredients, and then put them together. Well, I guess like on television, right? You put them together at the time, and then you take the rice that you've cooled and put it in. It makes a lovely community dish. So we're then going to take, and we're going to kind of push the vegetables and stuff that we've got in the wok, the garlic, the onion, the ginger, and like that. And we're going to add the chicken, and we're going to add the rice, and we're going to have all the other ingredients. Well, the red pepper and the corn come later. Never mind. We're going to have the chicken and the rice, and we're going to stir fry them. And we're going to stir in the red pepper, the corn, the curry powder, and the salt. And we're going to toss the whole thing. And then this is kind of the cool part. In addition to using the cold rice, at the very end, you stir in the beaten eggs and you cook for another minute. Because it gives it kind of a nice eggy consistency, and then you don't have little clumps of hard-boiled scrambled eggs. I don't know how to say it, but if you do it, if you put the eggs in at the last minute, it'll give it a lovely texture without making those little chunks of hard egg that sometimes you get in there. So you have all the ingredients set out. You can do this ahead of time too, of course, and bring it and rewarm it if you have the capacity. It depends on the capacity. But if you've got the ability to have a community kitchen, excuse me, you can prepare all the pieces and then stir fry them, which is kind of cool. Anyway, so this is delicious, and you have more people. Of course, you do a double batch, and it is very popular. but it is my adventure recipe because it has more ingredients. I recommend highly against peanut oil, just in case. And it is somewhat, some of the ingredients might be unusual to some of the people. And I suppose it is a matter of personal taste. Yes, yes. But anyway, that is our adventure recipe. And we, ladies and gentlemen, are out of time again. My goodness, how it flies. I have greatly enjoyed having you. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for your participation. Thank you very much for your comments and insights. And we will have another topic next week. And I have learned something, I always do, and I hope that you do too. If you want to see archived episodes, the last five are on their website, recipeforpeacenow.com. If you want to write in, it's recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. And I look forward to another one of our shows together. Thank you very, very much. Bye-bye.